Hey, who? What? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
That's Greg.
My friend, we are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Oh dear, that's loud and annoying, isn't it? It's Radio Mysterioso here for August 2nd, 2015. I noticed that I've got that nice low Radio Mysterioso voice come in, which is, I noticed that a lot of other podcasts have some big low frequency voice going. distorted when it comes when they announce the show, like it's very important, and I don't know, maybe I'll change that. Anyway, today we have a round table, not a debate, a round table with three people who I have known for a long time, consider friends, and also have differences of opinion, which will come out on this show. But that's what they are, differences of opinion, and maybe I'll learn something during this show. The guests are, I think I'll do it in alphabetical order. First up, someone who has not been on this show before, Richard Dolan, who's the author of many books, including National Security, UFOs in the National Security State, 1 and 2, and After Disclosure, and probably a few others I'm leaving out. Rich, are you there?
I am indeed, Greg.
Okay. And Peter Robbins, who has been on the show before. In fact, one time we had him on the show, all we talked about was, I think, Peter, I just had you tell stories about traveling through India and Russia and Afghanistan. Yeah.
That was a great show.
I had a lot of fun on that show. Peter, of course, if you're listening to this show, you know who these people are. I will do a minimum of introduction. And, of course, author of the book Left at Eastgate, and also a not many people know, he's also a scholar and expert on the work of Wilhelm Reich. Am I not right there, Peter?
Well, I know a lot about it, and I've been involved for years.
And also, I've seen you speak about Reich, and yes. And not too many people do. I mean, I think he's a lot more known now than he used to be.
Yes.
And finally, our a guest and another friend of mine for a long time, who's been on the show many times. I don't know if he holds the record, but it's pretty close. Nick Redfern, author of so many books I can't count. And one of the people this morning said, could you please ask Nick which book he wrote this morning?
That was yesterday's, actually, not today. I'm still working on that one.
Hey, I have to jump in here and say I am the only one of you guys who knew Nick before he had published a book, and now he's published 847.
That's true. I met Peter for the first time in the summer of 97 when he was over with Larry Warren promoting Left at Eastgate. This was about 3 or 4 months before my first book, A Covert Agenda, came out, and they were doing this countrywide tour. It's basically like a band on tour, you know, going from city to city and town to town promoting the book. Yeah. And, you know, we got to know each other in the best way possible by hanging out and just, you know, chatting. And it was a cool couple of weeks, you know, sort of hanging out with the guys and getting to know them.
It was a great way to meet you, Nick.
All of you I've known for quite a while. Last time I think I saw Richard was at the Wake Up Now conference. Rich, remember that in 2012 in New Mexico?
Not really.
Yeah, you've been. Yeah, you've been to about 800 of them. Anyway,
Wake Up Now.
I gave a talk about how UFO study should change.
I could remember it. I can remember it better.
Angel Fire. Was that Angel Fire?
No, the Angel Fire was Janet Saylor. This was a woman in Albuquerque.
Somewhere in New Mexico. I don't know.
This was at the, I think, the something Star Casino just slightly north of Albuquerque.
I mean, I've seen you in the last couple of years.
Yeah. And also, actually, when people say, you know, how do you know, what is it with you and Rich? The first time I met you, Rich, was at the National UFO Conference in Hollywood, and we had dinner with Strieber and Ann Strieber, Whitley Strieber and Ann Strieber.
Oh, yeah. I remember that very well.
Yeah. And I think Linda Howe and Terry, what was his name? He wrote the Flying... Huh?
Could it be Terry Hansen?
Yes, Terry Hansen.
Yeah, I think he was. He unfortunately died recently.
Yes, I heard.
So sad. No, we had a great time there, and I enjoyed meeting you, and as I recall, Linda Moulton Howe pretty much dominated the table.
Yes, I kind of wanted to talk to Whitley quite a bit, and I did beforehand, before most people got there, and I found out both of us were pyros, which was pretty
Linda
fun.
Linda has lots of stories to tell, and it was pretty interesting, so...
At that point, I don't think I'd even put out a book, or at least Project Beta. I was still working on it, or it was just about to be published. And you and your wife at the time, Karen, were exceedingly nice to us. And I didn't have any place to put my bags because I had to check out. So you let us put your stuff in your room.
Thanks.
So this is how I remember Rich. The way this show came about was that a couple of the listeners said, did you know that Peter Robbins and Richard Dolan were just on a show called podcast called Where Did the Road Go?
Yeah.
And that was, I think it was recorded or at least broadcast on June 13th.
Yep. Out of beautiful Ithaca, New York.
Oh, that's how you were both there.
Yep.
Okay. You were both there in studio. It sounded like you were in a studio. I could hear like kind of the studio ambience. Or at
we
least
live
a,
fairly
a room.
Close to each other. I'm in Rochester. Peter's in Ithaca. And, we visit each other. I mean, actually, I see Peter several times every year.
And I'll see you next week.
That's right. You'll be in Rochester. But he had organized a couple of interviews that he said, look, I'd like you to be down here. And I finally said, yeah, let's do it in June. So we did.
And one really wonderful feature of that, our host, Soraya, who also does their music show in the afternoon, knows that Rich and I are both jazz fans. And so he basically turned over their music show to us, and we spent several hours going back and forth.
He did a jazz show.
Pieces of our favorite jazz. It was such a great change of pace. We got to be disc jockeys and talk about some of our favorite musicians. Covered
that's
that's great.
Great, unfortunately. But it's
from the 1920s right to the present. And, yeah, I'd do that again in a second.
Yeah, well, I probably will. Since Rich is the one that hasn't been on the show, think about this, Rich. I will play any piece of music that you want as the outro to the show. Either I'll play it while you're on, if I've got it, or I can find it on YouTube, or I will add it afterwards, at least, you know, a better version of it. I have a lot of jazz up to about 1940 or so. After that, not so
good.
Much. Yeah. So that during that show, I think that the theme of the show was, you know, what is the state of ufology? And during the show, somebody said that either you or either one of you, Peter or Richard, had mentioned my name and said that I had called for a reboot of ufology. And if somebody thinks I said that, if I did say it, I regret it because I never said I wanted a reboot. Well, I never said that was a good idea. I said that change was a good idea, and in some in some cases, quite severe change. But we'll get into those during the show here.
Sure. I'll just add, Greg, that if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Soraya himself who mentioned that, because I certainly hadn't heard your statement.
Yeah.
So
our host.
Right. I would assume that I or Peter and I were both just responding to how Soraya characterized your statement or the statements of other people.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I figured I should listen to it first beforehand just to see what you guys had said. Hey, Rich, I think you're probably still a little bit distorted.
Oh, how about now? If I move farther away from the mic, is this better?
Oh, that's a little better, yeah.
All right. I'll get a little farther away.
Okay, so in my notes I said that, you know, maybe that the methods of research and questions asked ought to be modified a bit, at least for, you know, going forward. And I also said that large UFO groups are not equipped to study a phenomenon except as a data gathering entity. I think I actually said that in my talk. I hope I did in 2012. The reason I think the tipping point here, and I promised Rich we'd only talk about this for about 10 minutes, was the slides episode, fiasco, debacle, whatever you want to call it, and how quickly just a few people saying, well, let's take a look at this very closely and see what we come up with, how quickly it was solved, and how that affected how people thought about some of the bigger researchers in some of kind of the standard bearers in the UFO community and what kind of research they did. Because what I told Rich earlier was that I made a concerted effort to ignore it because I thought it will not change anything. The believers will believe and the skeptics or non-believers will be skeptical, not believe. And it kind of was that way. But in light of what happened, people that seemed a little bit more circumspect and really wanted to, were very into the subject and really wanted to find the best research said, hey, wait a second. This is something that hasn't happened in the past, and it actually shows that maybe you should do your own research or reserve judgment before making a decision. And I thought that was very important for the field, such as it is.
But let me just jump in.
Yeah, somebody jump in and say, you know, what your kind of assessment of it was, what you thought of it, and how right. you think it's changed things, because I think it has, even just a little bit.
If anyone here in this discussion, I'm the only one who was in Mexico City during that event.
Right.
I guess I'll just say that actually, like you, Greg, I stayed very much away from the debate during most of its development. I mean, whereas Nick Redfern, I think, had followed this and was very much involved in many ways that I was not, and really making very good contributions to that debate, by the way. I watched it from afar. I was very interested in it. And, you know, the basic claim was that you had Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, who believed that they had come across two slides that depicted an extraterrestrial being. And they kept it very close to the vest. Now, what I learned from them is that they first of all, I guess I'll just say I never believed ever that either of them were being dishonest about those slides. And there were people, and some of them were very vocal about this, who claimed or accused them of being dishonest and of being con men and so forth. And I think absolutely not. Absolutely not. But what they were, I think, is they got very, very taken in by this and very enthusiastic. The only reason I went at all, this was a last-minute thing. It was long after the event was planned for Mexico City. I was asked to go at the last minute to give my thoughts on the implications of this, if this were legitimate for disclosure. This is what Jaime Musan asked me to talk about, and I thought about it. I actually waited close to a week. I spoke at length to Don Schmidt, and also secondarily to Tony Bergaglia, who a lot of people know was involved in discussing this and investigating it. And it was after talking with both of them, who were as gung-ho could be, that I thought, I'll go. And I never agreed to endorse the slides in any way, and I was never asked to either. But I will say, I mean, as far as my own attitude on it went, although I never said that I thought they depicted an extraterrestrial, I did say that I thought the testimony of the physiologists that Jaime Musan had brought in, there was one English-speaking individual and several Spanish-speaking ones, I learned they said through translation, I thought that they were impressive. I mean, I have no problem saying that. They talked about how the physiology of this was not human and how and so forth. And I'm not a physiologist. My attitude was, well, if these are going to be debunked, then you're going to have to deal with those arguments. They could be debunked, but it seems to me that's the starting point. So I did say that. And in the immediate aftermath of the event, and this is before the placard was deblurred, I really angered Jaime and Don and Tom, frankly, by distancing myself from those images, because I really did not believe
people.
I mean, there were just too many people who came out and really made a very strong case to me. Said, look, there's no way that this is an extraterrestrial. And, you know, I really started to look at this and I thought, oh, man, I think they're absolutely right. And then I think 2 days later, the team that really had gone into this and that had used the Adobe deblurring software.
They used a different software.
A number of people individually had not been able to do, but a team of researchers did it, and they absolutely succeeded in deciphering that placard, which made it clear this was a two-year-old mummy of a child. So that was the nail in the coffin right there. And I agree. I think that this was a very important development and a very positive development in ufology. I do feel that there were people who were getting extremely emotional against myself and also against particularly Tom and Don, and also Jaime Musan was catching, you know, continues to catch a lot of hell over this. The one person I don't hear getting a lot of hell over it is Adam Dew, who's of all the people involved, the one person that I still wonder about in terms of his involvement. But all I would say is I think that those other three individuals, in my opinion, Jaime, Tom, and Don, I think were just very enthusiastic, and I think they would be the first to tell you now. Particularly, I don't know about Jaime, I can't speak for him, but Tom and Don, I think, have both said they got they lost their judgment. And it happens. I don't think it's the Armageddon, frankly, that some people try to turn it into. UFO research, since its beginning, has been filled with one controversy after another. It just doesn't end. This is another one. We have to just deal with it and you move on. It's intrinsically, in my opinion, this is the most difficult of topics to study. It's just difficult. And on top of that, in my own view, there is government obfuscation on top of that, which doesn't make it easier, and so you're groping around at times and make a mistake. You have to acknowledge it and move on.
Okay. Hey, Peter, what was your impression of how this affected everything?
Yeah, I actually was on the speaking bill with Don Schmidt at a regional Pennsylvania MUFON conference a week or a week and a half after Mexico City. We sat up quite late into the night before the conference, and discussed just this. Don is an old friend. He's somebody who I have a lot of respect and admiration for. I think he is a good guy, an honest guy, really has worked very hard as a Roswell research specialist, and he was really heartsick. He even began his talk, and he must have spent close to 15 minutes going over some of what we had discussed on our own the night before, that, as Rich said, you know, you work very hard in one particular focused area of research, and somebody alleges that they have hard new information on your subject. Of course, you're going to be interested. I like Jaime Musan. He's a nice guy. I don't agree with him on everything. I think he's done a very important job of bringing to the attention of North Americans video footage that would not necessarily have been played here. But I think Jaime also has an aspect to him that is showmanship. Maybe it is part of the culture, South and Central American culture, that I am not part of. There's an exuberance and a leaning toward events and spectacle. When I first heard about the event, my first thought was, after seeing the images, I don't think so. My second thought was, if he had contacted me, as he contacted Rich, and said, listen, Peter, I know you're not a Roswell specialist, but I know that you work for the city as a consultant directly for the city out of the mayor's office, that for 2 years you were a liaison with the office of the mayor to the office of then Governor Richardson of New Mexico on any UFO related matters. And what a cool job that was for a few years. And that you're known to have a good reputation, and I'd like to hear for your opinion. My first thought would not have been, well, I don't like this picture. I think this is going to be bogus. Honest to God, my first thought would have been, wow, Mexico City. I have never been there. Imagine having Mexican food in Mexico. And I'm only half joking. I would like to see what's going on. And, yeah, maybe I'll sell some books or make some new contacts or whatever. But what seemed to have occurred there was more showmanship than substance. And for me, the more disturbing aspect of it was, you know, people say in this work about people like us occasionally, and of course it would be ludicrous if it wasn't so insulting and untrue, that we're in it for the money. Well, I don't know about you guys. I'm just in it for the women. but they're, you know, they're really, I don't know anybody that makes a living doing this. Some of us have good months or, you know, every once in a while an extraordinary project and get to pay some bills. We do it because we have a passion for the subject, in some cases because we're more idealistic than practical. But to bring it down to that level is usually insulting. However, this was pay-per-view, and from what I understand, somebody or some bodies did walk away making a lot of money. Anybody can correct that or augment it if they want.
Well, I can jump in and say the biggest moneymaker was the National Auditorium of Mexico City, guaranteed. I don't know any of the numbers in detail, but I know that that was an expensive venue.
Yeah, and
a lot of money,
an awful lot of people attending, especially in terms of American events. We're talking about, was it several thousand people, Rich?
I thought it was 7,000 initially, but I think the number turned out to be a little bit less than that.
Okay,
but whatever,
yes.
It was a
10,000 seat theater that was about 2/3 to 3/4 full. That's what our friend Red Pill said, that who was there actually in the audience, and also I've heard many quotes about how many people watched online, and the take runs into probably, you know, in the six figures somewhere, or actually seven figures.
Mm.
And so somebody did make money. I don't think it all went to
seven figures, Greg.
Huh?
Thanks for the clarification there. But
well,
to jump back.
Stop. I need, what is seven figures?
Over $1 million. Based on numbers that were released, I don't know who released the numbers, but that's what I heard. Could be wrong. Like I said, I'm not going to sit here and argue about it.
Yeah, I can't see that as realistic at all.
And just complete my thought, which was what I got from Don Schmidt was, in so many words, I got caught up in this. I wanted, you know, like that, the classic X-Files poster, the wording always struck me with a certain irony. It wasn't that I believe, it was I want to believe. And it is something we all have to be very careful about. But he said I got caught up in it. And the next thing I knew, I realized I had made a big mistake. And what he said to that audience was, I made an error. Can you forgive me? I am sorry. And can I now get back to my work? And for some people, no, you can't. You screwed up, and how can we ever trust you again? Well, for me, that's ludicrous, condescending, and, you know, we all do it in our lives. We are just human. But this goes to part of the heart here. Those of us that have been around long enough and have a certain visibility in this work, which again is a microcosm of the people in the world. We are different sized fish in a relatively small pond internationally, but still within that area of study, we're known commodities. And, if you don't keep coming up with something new, if you don't have an angle to get yourself invited to the next conference, or a new book, or an outrageous claim, or a rageous claim, it may affect, you know, your visibility. And so some people will push that envelope. Other ones will go quiet for periods of time. And when they do have something to add to the dialogue that's worthwhile, it will be picked up on, and they will rejoin the fray. But ego certainly is part of what is at issue here. And I've actually been giving this a lot of thought because over the past few years, the term ufology has gone from one to describe a very inexact science where you have quite a number of people sincerely coming at a subject that is extremely provocative and very important from different angles, trying to make sense of it and ideally doing their best to present their findings or their best take on it in a reasonable manner. But the term has now become more of a curse word or an insult. There was a time when the word liberal was something that people spoke about proudly. Now, even liberals don't like to be identified as liberals because, in part, the media has, you know, look up the definition of the word. It's actually quite inspiring. Be that as it may, we are in a time where there's a certain Roman Colosseum aspect going on here and a certain amount of highly irresponsible, sensational work, if you want to call it work, that really needs to be criticized and very specifically and in a way that is also constructive.
Hey, Nick.
Yeah.
Same question to you. What do you think this episode we've been talking about the slides, you know, how did you feel about it first and what do you think we're going to take away from it?
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, I think, you know, the whole thing for ufology, I think regardless of, you know, who said what, et cetera, and how it all played out and looking at it retrospectively, I think for ufology, it is a disaster and an embarrassment. I think, you know, and the reason why I say that, and this is one of the things I think ufology should be mindful of and should change its approach, is in relation to how the slides issue was actually built up beforehand. There was an expectation. Word started to get out, and then, you know, it was, well, yeah, we've got this, and it's going to surface soon. We're having it analyzed. To me, that is almost like a recipe for disaster because you're setting something up, and very often in controversial issues, you set it up so high that it collapses and falls. And had it been me, I know people who take another approach are going to say, well, it's all with hindsight. You know, no one can say that other people are going to look at things. But from my perspective, had I been working with, say, Adam Dew, and there'd be one other person, we would have agreed not to say anything, no build-up, no teasers, and I would have looked into it to the point where eventually yes. I might have been able to prove that it actually was a mummy from the relevant museum they said it was in. And mm-hmm. had I proved that and found that out and nothing had been put into the public domain, I wouldn't have needed to put anything in the public domain at all anyway. It would just be quietly filed away as the hoax. And my view would have been, well, if I... You know, if it's revealed, there's going to be people who want to believe it anyway. Like Peter said, that whole I want to believe angle. But I think the more controversial the story, we should, and this is, we learned a perfect lesson from this, we should just stay as quiet as we can until we have reached the point where we're 100% sure, 100 or 150% sure, we cannot take the story any further. Now, the problem was with the slides, what really caused the big issue was that we had specific statements saying that, you know, we've had people look at the placard. I mean, there were references, I forget the actual specifics, but I'm sure Peter and Greg and Rich will recall that the Pentagon was mentioned, or somebody from the Pentagon as who the placard was going to be shown to. Nobody could decipher it. And then within 72 hours of the event, it was deciphered. I think that's the biggest bit of damage that was done in terms of how people looked at it. And as I said, had there been no attempt to build it up and create the fanfare, it was all done quietly, and then it collapsed, but nobody knew outside of the team, that would be a very different thing. And I think, you know, we can look at that and learn a great deal from that angle. I think Peter made a good statement as well when he said, so the event itself, there was more sort of fanfare than there was substance. And I think, you know, again, that's something that ufology very often uses to its cost. You know, it's to its detriment in terms of something is really sensationalized. You know, this is finally going to be it. And it isn't, you know, sort of making proclamations and forecasts, I think, is one of the worst things that ufology can do. I mean, although Rich has written about disclosure, I don't see Rich doing this, but there's been so many other people in disclosure who say, it's coming next year, you know, I've been told.
Oh,
it's
God,
coming next
absolutely.
Year.
Next week.
And then next year comes, and it's next year. The people who say those kind of things or who give massive forewarning of something important that's coming, I think they often don't realize that people in ufology don't forget this. You know, that they remember that. And so I think that's important. And,
yeah.
And one of the other issues that I think is important is the way in which, you know, sort of there are people who become, not through no fault of their own, you know, they become part of the, on the fringe of the Roswell slides issue. And certainly, you know, that was my perspective. You know, I was into the story quite early on because of a rather bizarre series of events that in which I was given the name of the Rays. And, you know, and then I shared that data with Rich Reynolds, and Rich published something at his blog about it as well in the roughly the same time frame. And then it started to get out. And actually Kevin Randall, who was part of the Dream Team, phoned me up and said, hey, you know, what's this about? And I said, what do you mean what it's about? You're part of the Dream Team. And he's like, well, yeah, but no one's told me. Can you tell me? So there was this bizarre situation where Kevin actually got the story of the slides from me because he was out of the loop.
Mm.
And so, in other words, you have this chaotic situation which should not have been chaotic. I should have been out of the loop. Kevin, you know, and if they didn't want to share it with Kevin, then they should have made sure he was out of the loop. But what happened was it was bad. I think it was badly mismanaged. And I think that's what we can learn more than anything else, is when we get into a really controversial case, a controversial event, let's not share it with everybody and his brother until we're sure it's actually worth sharing. Let's quietly investigate without any fanfare, without any, oh, you're not going to believe what I've heard, this kind of thing. Just forget all that until, you know, the case is, as I said, been taken as far as we can.
Yeah.
And if it goes nowhere, well, don't tell anyone because it's only going to muddy the waters even more. If it goes somewhere, then put it out.
Nick, I agree with everything you've said here, absolutely every single thing. I would like to add, you may know this, you may not know this, but it seems to me that every one of the key missteps along the way was actually the work of Adam Dew. And I'm really not,
well,
I wasn't interested in singling him out, but it really is true. He claimed ownership.
The big problem you had there was that, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong because you're at the event, but if I'm correct that he didn't supply the high-res picture to Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, did he? If I remember right.
I don't know about that. That may be true.
Whether he did or not, it was only when we really got to see the high-res one that we had an ability to actually decipher it because, you know, the other ones were just sort of,
well,
you know, literally kilobytes or whatever.
He did what I was told he did, and I didn't get this from him, was that when he gave the placard images to other researchers for them to decipher, he only gave them a cropped image of the actual JPEG. This is a huge thing, because when you're doing a de-blur, you need as much data obviously as possible, and if you're just giving them only the placard or the placard and a little bit more, that makes it much more difficult. And I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but this is, again, what I was told, that that was what he did. So, in other words, you know, there's a couple of reasons you might infer he did this, and I don't know what those reasons were.
What I would add to that is, had it been me who was liaising with Adam Dew, and I was expected to support this, you know, based on conclusions, obviously, what I would say to him, or to any hypothetical situation where somebody's got something and they share it with you and this, you know, this is going to be the biggest story, I would have said, well, if I'm going to support this and it looks interesting and if you want me to support it, you sure as hell are going to have to hand over everything. And if I don't get to see everything, to me, that makes alarm bells. So you hand over everything or you find someone else, because I'm not going to work with, you know, something that should be a couple of, you know, 3 or 4 megabyte quality versus, you know, something that you've just copy pasted a book cover from Amazon, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I do want to say that. Well, I made my biggest mistake, and I'll just put this out, was that I went in there based on trust, and I did not, like, before I went there, I'd only followed the controversy from afar, like many other people. I wasn't in it in a detailed way, so that was problem number one, and I really, that should have given me pause. But problem number two is I just went in on trust, really, in conversations with Don Schmidt and Tony Bergaglia. And really, I should have done much more than that. And I agree with you. I mean, if there is one big mistake that I did is putting my name associated with this event. I really should have done way more investigation. But the thing was, an alarm bell should have been going off because the slide was not presented to me before I went there. They were keeping it very proprietary.
Yeah, well, it's, a lot of this stuff should be vetted beforehand. Or, as Nick said, if you're doing research on something and this is something I've been kind of harping on for quite a while here, it should be done quietly in a small group until you have your conclusions, and then present those absolutely freely to everyone with everything you've done and the exact method you've done it, so that they can reproduce it and find and do what you did.
I think that's exactly what Don and Tom were trying to do. I really believe that, and I think that all of this got out honestly due to Adam Dew. Because there was he went down to, I think it was Midland, and was asking around, and actually people started becoming very suspicious. And if I'm not mistaken, my understanding is that's when Nick Redfern received a phone call. You got that mysterious phone call.
Wasn't Adam Dew, though. It was definitely an old guy, and he was basically...
No, it wasn't saying, Adam Dew who called you, but it was an old guy who had encountered Adam.
I'm not that far away from Midland, actually, where I live, in just outside Dallas, you know, just a couple of hours.
Adam was going around down there and stirring things up, and I think he basically allowed this to get out in that way. I think that Don Schmidt and Tom Carey were very interested in keeping this quiet. I mean, that's the impression that I got from them. But it really got away from them because they didn't have control over the sides.
My last word would be that if I was going to get involved, I would demand I had control. You know, if they want somebody to support it and investigate it, you know, I would say, look, I demand everything. You better give me everything, or I'm not involved.
Yeah, well, Peter mentioned something that I wanted to... I said maybe 10 minutes on this. It has been now 30 minutes or 35 minutes.
No surprise.
Big surprise, of course. Peter mentioned something that it was going to be one of my talking points here, and that is the fact of in-groupness, ego, and things like that that affect people's, the way they look at information and the way they disseminate information and how they present it. And while not calling for a reboot at all, another things that I said was that maybe media, publishing, all those things should be left out of the equation until some sort of a conclusion is reached by a consensus of more than a few groups, like two or three small groups working in by themselves, saying, "We found this. Why don't you try it?" And this does not go out on the, you know, this does it. People refuse interviews and refuse, you know, that's really hard to do. But I think it would help the subject and would help the information and the way the information is examined.
If I might jump back in here, some thoughts that have been going through my mind, especially since we decided to do this roundtable. First, we're dealing with a field where, say, unlike official professional colleagues, say, in law or in medicine, where your professional ethics, your integrity, if you violate a procedure or do a surgery unlicensed, the American Medical Association or the Bar Association or the American Psychiatric Association can censure you, charge you with malpractice, take away your license to practice, so to say. Ufology, I mean, you know, MUFON field training to become an investigator aside, which is a good training, is a totally unregulated area of study. As I understand it, the qualifications in order to call yourself a professional ufologist are essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you can touch your finger to your nose and you turn around three times and you are a ufologist by your own declaration. Now, again, I'm only half joking here. maybe there'll come a time in future after disclosure, which may come next week, of course, or in 1,000 years or never, where in that AD period, as Richard's wonderful book with Bryce Zabel talks about, after disclosure, among the things that I think will change will be that academia, now not afraid to express their opinions because the ridicule factor will have been exploded, departments of study will begin to be formed in various universities and colleges. Out of this may come professional associations where essentially you will register to do this work, and it will be, you know, in tandem with other colleagues and the like. However, this is a pipe dream. And right now, anybody's point of view or theory or knowledge, and again, who is to say that my, you know, here I am at the lowest level, at the lowest vibratory level. I'm like a cop. My three mentors were a staff officer in Hungarian military charged with overseeing photo analysis during World War II for that army. Dear Bud Hopkins, who was a brilliant self-trained investigator, and a guy named Pete Mazzola, who was a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective. I was taught, and I still adhere to, investigation and research almost in a law and order kind of manner, where you begin as a cop and you zone in on a story, you collect evidence, it moves on to the legal process where you try to triangulate. The work that Larry Warren and I did around the Rendlesham Forest incident embodies for me some of the best work I've ever done, and some of the evidence truly is worthy of a court of law. You have extraordinary physical evidence derived from the location of the exact spot where Larry's event took place in a farmer's field. Triangulated on that, you have photographic evidence. You have multiple witness testimony, an unbreakable military paper trail, and you know, a history in the of such phenomenal anomalous activity in that part of Suffolk, and so on. Now, for somebody else, they can say, well, my evidence is that the Akashic record has told me this, and the Martians that I channel have told me that, and I'm highly intuitive. And how are you, you know, how dare you say that I'm wrong? There is no overriding review or team of colleagues. What it all comes down to is the intellectual equivalent of a Wild West town lacking a marshal or sheriff. And that's part of the problem we're faced with in trying to be taken more seriously by the rest of society and of doing our best work. For me, it comes down to holding yourself to your highest ethical, research, scientific standards. I've developed a series of protocols that I do my best to work off of, but I can't impose that on anyone else, and they can't impose theirs on me. So we really are at a quandary and a crossroads in how we move forward. The other thing, just before I turn the floor back to you guys, is the emphasis from the get-go, beginning in 1947, which was really the birth of the science of UFO studies in modern times. It's all, the focus has been overwhelmingly on the so-called researchers, investigators, muckrakers, authors. It has not been where it should be, namely on the people without whom we would have nothing to do. The actual witnesses who have had the courage to come forward, the people who have had the courage to talk about the experiences that were so well pioneered by Bud Hopkins, who arguably is the true father of scientific abduction studies. Whether you have a problem with the subject or not, I am one of those people who has not had the luxury of disbelief on this for many years. I got into the work quite abruptly 40 years ago, when my sister Helen, at a time when abductions was not a subject, told me archetypical memories, of, I've heard them hundreds of times now, of her experiences as a child. Then, you know, I could go on. You guys get the gist, though. But how do we bring this under one umbrella? How do we begin to institute a dialogue among colleagues, no matter how disparate they are, to bring these matters to the fore and find a way to, you know, move forward? I don't know the answer to the question.
You're asking about peer review, or at least I think you're moving in that direction.
Yep,
and that's
exactly.
That's a fundamental question we should be asking. I've been thinking about this for well 15 years since I've been involved in ufology. I gave a lecture. My very first MUFON symposium lecture ever was way back in 2002, and it was on the exact subject of peer review, which MUFON was talking about at that conference. And I was the dissenter, to be honest with you, and I still am. I'm skeptical of the value of true peer review in this field. One question to ask is, who are the peers to do the review? We might ask Nick, you know, for any of the books that he's written, would, you know, how would he have felt to have them subjected to the review of various ufological peers, whether they approve or reject his work based on their whim? I think it's a very slippery slope. I think the real contributions to this field have been made by essentially what we can say independent intellectuals, independent scholars doing their thing. That's the nature of scholarly research for the most part. Most scholarly research is not collaborative. It works off of the of other people's work, of course, but the nature of the scholarship is always the work of a loner. That's the work of the university scholar. And so, you know, in the academic world, peer review has a function. But you go into the academic world and you can find many, many scholars who have serious critiques of the so-called peer review that they are subjected to, and in fact the corruption that is involved in the academic world in peer review. I mean, all of these institutions are fallible. So I think that we're really mistaken if we think that we're going to find a magic bullet that's going to solve the problems. And the other thing about peer review is that I believe it's an inherently conservative institution. It's not necessarily the worst thing in the world, but it's not necessarily the best. And, you know, one peer review organization, you might say, within the legal field is the Supreme Court, and they gave us Dred Scott. So I think none of the peer reviews systems that are in place are infallible. And, I think we need to be careful before we particularly, again, within the field of UFO research, because, again, my contention is that this is a truly difficult, truly mysterious field in which we are probably in over our heads in many ways, and we'll probably never get to the true bottom of some of these mysteries that we're dealing with, because very likely we're dealing with realities that we're not equipped cognitively, I think, to understand. So we're always going to be groping around in the dark to some extent. That's the way it is.
Yeah. Nick and I have spoken about this between each other quite extensively. Nick, I think you will probably say what I was going to say, so you go ahead.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think is important about peer review, and this gets to what Rich just said about how ufology is such a, you know, a strange and almost unique sort of subject, is that, you know, if you're, say, for example, you know, you're a leading cancer specialist or something like that, somebody comes up with a new theory or claim that, you know, they've successfully cured cancer, this data needs to be peer-reviewed. Now, one of the reasons why it's peer-reviewed is because we know and have proved that cancer exists. You know, it's a reality. Unfortunately, it is, you know, but still a reality. The problem is with ufology is, although clearly something's going on, we're still dealing with a definitive unknown, which, you know, it kind of makes it difficult to peer review something that hasn't physically been proved to exist to, you know, the vast majority of the population, or it just literally isn't proven, you know, to everybody, even to ufology. You know, we've got a lot of data, but we still don't have the hard evidence. So in other words, peer reviewing a phenomenon that hasn't been proved to exist is incredibly difficult to do. You know, it's very different to peer reviewing someone's research on how he or she claimed to have destroyed a cancer cell. You know, that kind of thing. It's totally different. And so essentially a peer review in ufology becomes the equivalent of like a good or bad review, you know, in 14th Times book review page or something like that. And so for that reason, you know, peer reviewing can be an ideal situation, but he, you know, it's kind of, Rich brought up a good point when he said about, you know, how would I feel about my books being peer reviewed? You know, I've written about 15 books on UFOs altogether. Some of them, you know, like the first one, Covert Agenda, covered British government files on UFOs, clearly showing a real phenomena, which, you know, is clearly to me from something from somewhere else. Now, if that book was peer-reviewed against, say, my Body Snatchers in the Desert book, which gave, like, a down-to-earth military experiment angle for Roswell, now, regardless of whether or not I was deceived or, you know, this was disinformation or whatever, a peer review, I don't believe, and this isn't me knocking ufology, but I don't believe I would have stood much chance of having a balanced peer review, as I view a ufological peer review.
That's right.
I don't believe I could have had a balanced peer review of the Body Snatchers book, because nobody in ufology wants to hear anything other than the UFO angle. So, you know, I think to sort of just boil it down to one point, I think peer review is important, but I think it's an incredibly difficult thing to achieve in ufology, as
it's also
by the definition of what peer review actually is.
Just quickly to state, when I was involved in organizing the annual Roswell conference, and Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I brought you in 2008 or 2009 to give a talk on that very subject in the heart of
2007. Yeah.
Okay. In the heart of enemy territory, and you did a great job.
The reason why, you know, I was happy to do it because, you know, I'm one of these people who, if you like me, agree with, that's fine. If you don't, well, that's fine too. I'm not going to lose sleep over it if people, you know, I don't kiss ass. People can agree, you know, like what I do or not like it, but I'm not going to lose sleep over it. And I believe if the controversial data surfaces and you investigate it to the best of your ability and then you put it out for people to see what you found, you know, that's what we should do. I mean, it's kind of like if somebody proved tomorrow that the Cash Landrum case wasn't a UFO case, that it was a military experiment. And I think, you know, that for me, that case could go both ways. But I would hope that if somebody's researching that now and they've come to the military conclusion, I would hope they wouldn't be fearful of what ufology would think about them if they put it out, and that would actually prevent them from putting the book out. You know, it's like, I think me and Rich are the only two people who've ever spoken at every single conference that Ryan Wood put on, the Crash Retrieval Conference. But, you know, I didn't give a thought about whether Ryan wouldn't book me again if I wrote the Body Snatchers book. You know, that was irrelevant. And so, so again, you know, I think we need to have this approach where there shouldn't be an emphasis on, well, what's the rest of ufology going to think if I do this? You know, that's, to me, that's a weakness. If like, that's the first thing on your mind, that's a weakness. You know, we need to be, no, this is what I think, and I'm putting it out. And I think, but again, that comes to peer review. You're not going to get I honestly don't think I would get a good peer review for the Body Snatchers book, not because people might not think it's valid, but because it's not what they want to hear. That's what it boils down to.
This goes back to the ego thing, and what are people going to think, and you know, the larger question is, do there need to be experts? Do people need to have letters after their name just to get respectability, or should the respectability thing be thrown out the window? I think it should, and results in you know, the theater of public opinion, as much as you can get out into the public, I think would be more, it would move things further down the road. The other thing I think, and I've been harping on this for a while, see what you guys think of this, is if there is a breakthrough that will come in the UFO field, I don't believe it's going to come from a ufologist. I think it's going to come from somebody from a completely different discipline, whether they're trained or not, that has an idea that seems to hold up and starts to blossom into something. Like a sociologist might say something, or a physicist, or a folklorist, or a psychologist, or something like that, that has an interest in the subject, comes at it from a different angle. And they're not somebody that's writing books about it. They're not somebody that shows up on the shows about it. They're not somebody that, you know, goes to do lectures about it. And they're not on the circuit at all. I have great hope for that coming from outside of the UFO community. And I would try to kind of secretly encourage people like that to get involved.
Oh, yeah. I would agree with you, but I would just look at it even differently than that, Greg, because I hate the term ufology. I mean, I
do, too. I try to never use it.
Because what really, I mean, am I a ufologist? Are you a ufologist? Is Peter or Nick a ufologist? No, what we are people who find many things in this world interesting, and that includes the subject of what we call UFOs. And a lot of things related to it. I've written several books on that have UFO on the cover, so I guess that says, oh, well, he's a ufologist, but I simply find the subject interesting. There are other people who have not written books yet on the subject. If this theoretical sociologist you're talking about, you know, becomes interested and makes a contribution, does that make him or her a ufologist, then? I mean,
I would hope that they would not even dare to call themselves
that. Their nose and turn around.
There's always the need for fresh blood and fresh ideas, absolutely, to enter this field. So to that extent, I totally agree. We're not going to get where we are if we've just got the same people year after year. There's always have to be new people coming in and with fresh ideas.
Yeah. Well, how do you back away? You know, and this is another big question. And I've been harping on this on my show for probably years now. How do you back away from the elephant in the room that is everybody's base belief that UFO equals ET and equals extraterrestrial? Because that's what everybody thinks. Not everybody, but that's the first idea that comes up. And that's how people come into it. Most people never shake that. And my idea is that there is something that is not human interacting with us occasionally. I'm pretty sure of that. What I'm not sure of is where it comes from, and I haven't seen, and like Nick said, I haven't seen enough evidence to tell me definitively, because I can't, it's not on demand, that this is coming, that these are things coming from other planets and structured craft.
Well,
and
that
might just be part of it, actually, too.
Yeah, I agree with you. The problem with the solution to this is that, actually, in my opinion, nothing, there's not one single explanation that makes any sense. So if you want to look at the terrestrial, there are many cases that really do not look like it's an extraterrestrial, although it's very strange, it doesn't seem extraterrestrial. There are many cases that do not seem like they are man-made Nazi-era technology. I mean, some may, but many others make it more difficult. Same with interdimensional theory, the same with time traveler theory, the same with simply the Donald Menzel, Philip Klass, skeptical, that it's all misidentifications. I mean, none of... There is actually no position that I'm aware of where, like, one solution is going to solve it, and that is one of the maddening things and one of the fascinating things, frankly, about this subject, that it doesn't easily lend itself to that. As far as the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, I continue to entertain it. I think only a fool would discount it entirely. I think that there are theoretical reasons why it could make sense, and I think that there are observational reasons why it also could make sense, at least some of the time. But that's not proof. Really what we have to do is, I think, put ourselves in a position where we have to be comfortable with the idea of uncertainty. I am, actually. I've come to that point. I don't really feel a need to push one solution over another. I'm interested always primarily in the politics of this, always have been, I always will be. That's how I got into this field. I look at geopolitics, cover-up issues. That's what gets me going. And I'm of the opinion that there is something there. There's a reality that is being covered up, and I have been interested in understanding that reality, but also equally interested in trying to understand the political mechanisms that interact with that and cover it up and subvert our world. So for me, I try to keep it real. That is, to keep it tangible and concrete to the extent possible. It's fun to speculate. I do that too. There's nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with speculating on what we're dealing with. The problem is, and I think everyone here can agree, we have to avoid a kind of religious type of dogmatic answer, like that it has to be this or it has to be that. I think we really have to maintain an open mind, knowing that there's something important, and it could be a number of things. And again, as I said earlier, it's very possible that we may never, I mean, really never get to the bottom of it. I know I wrote a book called After Disclosure, but even in that book, I hypothesized that doesn't mean we're going to really understand what we're dealing with.
Yeah, well, the thing I've talked about on the show, and Nick can speak to this too, is that when you're asking for disclosure, one, who has control over that, and do they care whether they give that to you? And two, are they going to disclose what you think they're going to disclose? And if they don't, you're going to cry cover-up. I think that's a problem that I see with a lot of it, too.
I asked all of those questions in my book. I mean, disclosure is not necessarily or even probably going to be a truthful thing. It'll be filled with spins and lies and ignorance.
Yeah, but if it matches up what everybody thinks it should be or most people, then they'll say that's the truth. But if it doesn't, they'll say it's not. And I think that's what people have to be on guard against.
Oh. It's going to be a god-awful mess.
Couple of thoughts. First of all, Greg, you brought up an interesting point about degreed professionals in the work. It's wonderful to have PhDs, people with advanced degrees, people, of course, in the sciences, mental health professionals, I think law enforcement, teachers, all realms. But sometimes coming from a background where you are naturally trained to think out of the box and come at things from an angle that a trained, technical, highly focused mind is not, is the way to go. We recently learned that who is this major internet billionaire and Stephen Hawking, that there is now $100 million that is going to be spent continuing to aim radio telescopes into space to send signals to try to get intelligent responses. Well and good. But if 1/1,000th of that were taken and used by professionals who had the courage to look at the best, how can I say, ufological establishment literature, starting, say, with Donald Kehoe and going right through the present, you know, being compelled to read Richard's books on UFOs and the national security state, looking at the archive of Bud Hopkins, doing scientific examinations of extracted non-terrestrial implants, for lack of a better term, that might be money well spent. I always felt that having a bachelor's of fine arts in painting and film history was a real asset to me. I've learned a lot on my own about investigation, the scientific realities surrounding how UFO phenomena or crop circle related phenomena, et cetera, truly affect the chemistry of organic materials. But I like the idea of that part of the area of study being wide open. MUFON, for example, if you are going to be able to, in order to qualify to be a quote-unquote consultant, you have to have at least a master's degree. I, for one, would not qualify then, even with my 40 years of practical experience in the field. You can do the right thing for the wrong reason sometimes and vice versa. As far as labeling, I have always thought of myself, at least for many years, as an investigative writer who tends to specialize in the subject of UFOs. The word ufologist, I'm old enough to remember when it started to be used. And, you know, it's for me, when you make up a word to describe something, there's always a certain self-consciousness to it. I will say the word here and probably never say it again. I hate the word selfie. I was perfectly comfortable with self-portrait. I don't like baby talk. I like the English language. What is people's problems with having to, you know, when I think it was in the 1970s when stores started using cutesy things like this, N apostrophe that, instead of the word N. I'm off on a tangent here, but language is important. Do we even need the word ufologist? People who, you know, look into and study this phenomena are simply just that, coming from different scientific or non-scientific disciplines. And as far as the extraterrestrial hypothesis, like you, Greg, one of my heroes in the work is Jacques Vallée, a great mind and truly one of the seminal thinkers in this field. And maybe you know the exact quote, but it's to the effect of, if I learned that the entire UFO phenomena were really only about machines of advanced technology manned by in other intelligences coming and going with impunity from somewhere out in space, I'd be very disappointed. The irony is that the extraterrestrial hypothesis has kind of emerged as the most conservative, the most sedate, the most safe one. And to perhaps slightly paraphrase Stan Friedman, the question is not, are UFOs representative of just what I'm talking about here, advanced technology manned by advanced intelligences coming and going from the planet Earth, from somewhere else out in the universe? The question is, has one of them ever been? And I think, as Richard said, it would be tremendously intellectually arrogant to assume otherwise. Now, that is just one of the things that I think is going on here. The other ones, again, anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's. But for most of us, we are pretty much stuck in the three dimensions. If you're a deep meditator, then perhaps four. But there's a lot more dimensions out there. And what we call reality is laughingly what we perceive through these two little slits with these rod and cone systems looking straight ahead. We hear a very limited range. We perish if it's a tiny bit too cold, a tiny bit too hot. Our brains work in such a way that we perceive to a certain point and not beyond. So, the folly of human arrogance in saying what they are or not definitively is just that. And for me, the people who really deserve the ridicule are those who know. I'm not talking about skeptics. We must all be skeptical as we move forward in this. It is one of our greatest assets to begin every investigation, whether it's sitting with somebody in a hotel lobby, hearing them out and trying to make a basic judgment about what they're telling you, or being involved for years in one specific investigation. But the debunkers who come from the point of view that they know that there is, for example, no extraterrestrial reality behind UFOs. How do they know this? And it was something I used to have talks, very lighthearted ones, with Bud Hopkins over the years, and his attitude was, these people are really important and they are really worthy of our respect because they know that there is no such thing as a UFO phenomena. Their mantra is, it can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else. So my job as a Phil Klass or a Donald K. Menzel or what have you is to patiently explain to you who, you know, I want to believe that it is, you know, a temperature inversion or swamp gas or war hysteria, or, you know, a test weapon or what have you. I'll shut up for now.
Hey, Nick, is there anything you wanted to add before I follow on with that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly the ETH is without doubt, you know, the most popular theory for those reports in the UFO history that remain unexplained. And, you know, there's a good argument to be made that it is extraterrestrial. But what I would like to see, and I think it would be important and also good for ufology, would be, you know, to sort of dig further into some of the more marginalized theories, not necessarily to champion them, but just to let more people in the field who are perhaps even new to the subject, just let them know that there are other scenarios. I mean, what I would love to see, instead of like a mainstream UFO conference where you've got one person talking on Roswell, somebody else on flying triangle statistics, you know, somebody on the latest from whistleblower from Area 51 or whatever, I think it'd be kind of really cool if, yeah, you did have someone who reveals all the latest they've uncovered on the extraterrestrial angle for Roswell. But then after that, how about we have a lecture on, for example, how people have, you know, have ingested psychedelics, and, you know, you have a lot of parallels mm-hmm. between certain abduction cases and what goes on when, for example, in people in DMT states. You know, there's some eerily close parallels between abduction phenomena and the altered mindset when somebody's under the influence of DMT. It's extremely similar. So I'd like to see, you know, that followed up, following on from the Roswell lecture. And then maybe a lecture, you know, if you know your ancient, well, not ancient history, early 20th century history with Aleister Crowley, you know, one of the world's most infamous magicians, whoever you want to term him, you know, had this Al-Mantra working where he conjures up this entity known as LAM. If you Google LAM, for those who are listening who may not know, L-A-M, it, look at Crowley's picture, it looks, you know, very close to the entity on the cover of Communion. And yet this interaction was achieved through an occult ritual. Now,
yeah, like
I know
1916.
Some people might be rolling their eyes at this moment, but on the other hand, you know, these are all valid areas of research, but mm-hmm. it's almost to me as if certain groups, the older groups, they don't want to rock the boat. Now, maybe it's a fear of not getting enough asses on seats at conferences. Maybe it's a fear of, well, what are people going to say if I start talking about magical rituals? Well, you know, and it's kind of, to me, even though I'm like Greg, I'm absolutely convinced there's an unknown UFO phenomenon from somewhere else. And even if there's a nuts and bolts angle to it, that doesn't explain how so many of us that get into this subject, when you start even just looking at the nuts and bolts angle, you start to experience weird synchronicities. I truly don't believe there's a researcher in the room or anywhere that hasn't had some really weird, profound synchronicities when they've been digging into this subject.
Absolutely.
And just nuts and bolts aliens from somebody else's equivalent of NASA cannot explain that. That if it's just someone else's version of NASA, that cannot spontaneously cause all these weird synchronicities to occur. So I think we definitely don't need to dismiss and move on from the ETH, but I think we need to give equal ground to some of these more esoteric and alternative theories, because we know something's going on, but if we're truthful with ourselves, we're just not sure what it is.
Nick, I completely agree with you 100%. I've formed a personal opinion, I suppose, of what we are dealing with is, I sometimes use the phrase a meta-intelligence as a beyond intelligence. I don't really know what this is, but there are some, in my own personal investigations, I've done some private investigations, come across some bizarre synchronicities. I mean, even beyond synchronicity, it's almost as if some of the individuals experiencing some of these events are able to kind of decipher communications that really seem to have been specifically for them and them alone, and that only they could have figured out. And I'm about to publish a book by a new author to the field under my company, Richard Dolan Press, a fellow named Mike Cleland. Some people listening, I bet, are familiar with him.
He's been on my show, Richard, more than at least once.
Mike is a fantastic mm-hmm. researcher. He's known as the owl guy because he's
yes.
done a lot of work on owls. Fascinating. I mean, mind-blowing stuff. But beyond owls, the whole concept of synchronicity is so big in his work.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, when this book comes out, this is going to be one of the most important books on encounters written in the last generation. But this is a direction that research does need to go, Nick. The conference that you hypothesize about, I could easily get interested in that. I think part of the problem that we had is the development of the UFO research field. Go back to the 1950s and think about the mentality of Western world, predominant American intellectual life of the 1950s. It was really very materialistic, very concrete. And those researchers were not talking about interdimensional. I mean, a few off, you know, off to the fringes of the fringe were, but by and large, mainstream of American culture and the mainstream of American ufology were very nuts and bolts. And the thing is that these things happen, the change happens through generations, I believe. so that it happens very slowly. But this field is much more radical than we are, much more radical. And so I think we have to listen to the field. And I think you're right. We have to pay attention to the nuance and the difficulties that it offers to our paradigm. And yeah. We have to be prepared to let our paradigm just dissolve away and to constantly to explore new ways of understanding this. I feel like we may never get to the bottom of it, but that's not the point. The point is the journey, honestly, because in my own journey, and I'll bet everyone else here, it's the journey that is the reward. In other words, you realize that your old reality that you were raised believing is illusory. But then you think, oh, well, I've understood a little bit here. So like maybe Nick was at that place with his first book, A Covert Agenda, and I was at that place with my first book, my first volume of UFOs and National Security State, where I thought, oh, yeah, what I thought was true, that's not true, but now this is more true. But then you go further down the road, and you realize, oh, well, yeah, where I was in my first book, actually, that's not quite right either. And you have to keep challenging your paradigm. You have to keep challenging your worldview. And if you're not doing that, you're really not doing this right. I have no idea, none, where I'm going to end up when I get to the end of my road. But I know it won't be where I am now. That's the only thing I can tell you.
Yeah, well, I hope that's the way we're all going. My question that followed on from a couple of things that Peter mentioned and also Nick was another thing I've been kind of discussing on my show based on stuff from Jacques Vallée, but also my friend Bruce Duensing, who passed away here last month. Do any of you guys know about him?
I didn't know that he had died.
Yeah, he went into the hospital for a bypass, and he didn't survive it.
Oh, God.
But he was on my show. I think he'd been on two or three other different shows over the years. I had him on my show, and it was one of those ones where it kind of changes my perspective. But the main thing I took away from Bruce was, how do we trust? And you know, Peter said this. He says, you know, the main thing we have is the witnesses. What is going on in the witnesses' heads that we can trust and that we can follow as something that is real? All we have is their impressions. We have their front-loaded ideas about what things should be. And as I think Joe McMonagle showed in one of his books, things that are going through your nervous system are completely different because they've gone through all kinds of subconscious filtering before it gets to your conscious recall or even hypnotic recall. So where are we left with that? Where are we left with the question of the instrument that is pulling the information in and being, you know, sent back out to researchers, databases, you know, field researchers, all that? There's another issue with that. I mean, that there was a study, well, it's not really recent, but most psychologists are aware that a lot of your memories and connections you make and all that are not exactly what happened, and they're sort of a amalgamation of what you think happened and what was suggested to you. Based on all of this, where are we left with when witnesses tell us what they've seen?
Well, you're talking about the fallibility of all witnesses. The work of Elizabeth Loftus, you might be referring to her indirectly, is famous in pointing out how human memory is totally fallible. So we all know this.
Especially on something that is completely outside of your experience when you're experiencing it.
Right. So now we have a choice. How do we deal with it? Do we ignore witness testimony?
Oh, no, we can't ignore it. But what do we do with it? I'm sorry, Rich. Go ahead.
What we have to do is our best, and our best is fallible. So, I mean, it's, again, we're dealing with a very difficult and truly mysterious phenomenon that has boggled the minds of many witnesses, left them incredulous of what they've experienced. On the other hand, my favorite cases to look into are some of the military cases of, and we really only have a comparative few compared with the amount of activity that is going on every year. Hell, last year there were about 15,000 reports put into the MUFON and National UFO Reporting Center websites combined. I mean, it's unbelievable. But, you know, we have a few pretty good, I would say very good, military cases where we have a variety of inputs of data, including electronic and radar data sometimes, combined with visual observations, and I think these are important. In other words, I would not suggest that we have to distrust all witness testimony. That seems, again, that seems counterintuitive and almost silly. What we have to say is that witness testimony can be fallible, but is it 100% fallible, or is it 50% fallible? I don't think it's 100% fallible, and I don't even think it's 50% fallible.
Yeah,
maybe it's 20% fallible. I don't really know what the number would be.
Or are our questions fallible?
What's that?
Or are our questions fallible?
Well, our questions are incomplete usually. I don't know if they're fallible.
Yeah.
We ask questions for things that we want to know about. And sometimes we don't ask the best questions.
Well, the answers are sometimes encoded in the questions, so that's another problem.
All right, I don't know where you're going philosophically with this.
Philosophically is...
Most structuralism, but
yeah.
I think we're all aware that reality is not an objective thing that we simply can grasp, you know, with 100% clarity.
Of course not.
Yeah.
You're grasping at metaphors, and through those metaphors, you try and find out what is behind those metaphors that you can possibly describe. Although, you know, words are going to be bad at describing them. Memories are going to be bad at describing them. But, yeah, there's a problem with that. And one of the things I said is, why don't we kind of expand what we ask people? What were you doing the day before? What is your family background? Do you have a history of mental problems? Does your family? What is your blood type? Yeah. What happened to you a week, a month, a year after the sighting? You know,
you
a lot
of
things
more
like
of a psychosocial approach to it, and that's totally valid.
Yeah.
Another valid way, and I think I'm talking a little too much, so I'm going to stop, but I want to say this one last thing, and I like to be what I call Cartesian about this, if I'm going to talk philosophical about this. In other words, what Rene Descartes said hundreds of years ago is he wanted a theory of knowledge that would work, and he said, you know, everything I grew up with is basically turns out to be illusion, lies and theology and claims not based on anything that I know is true. And he said, well, what do I know is true? And he said, well, I think, therefore I exist, I am.
Right.
And that was kind of a philosophical foundation for really our modern kind of scientific age. And I think that's a really good attitude. So, in other words, I translate that today into UFO research is what do I know as opposed to what do I think is true? And I always try to distinguish these. What do I know? Well, I don't know that UFOs are extraterrestrial. I don't know that they're interdimensional. They may be both. They may [S2]
Right. [S1]
Be neither.
Who knows?
But I know, I would say I'm pretty sure, to the extent that I know, that there is a thing going on that is being covered up, and I have my own arguments for that. So we have to be very careful when we formulate our own theory of knowledge, I would suggest, and know what we know and understand what we don't really know. And there's a big problem. Sometimes we get a little ahead of ourselves.
Right.
Can I put forward a couple of ideas, well, not even ideas, but whatever our area of investigation, whatever philosophy is informing it, whether it's in the directions that Nick Redfern has taken it with a phenomenal amount of research and investigation across a broad horizon, or somebody who is completely focused on, say, ghost hunting or past lives or ETH, a couple of thoughts that might assist us in just doing our best work and staying on point. Undertake no investigations with any agenda other than to follow the evidence trail where it goes and as objectively as your resources, critical thinking, and common sense will allow. Always take care to consider opinions and views that are contrary to your own. Be your own best devil's advocate. Always be in the habit of challenging your own beliefs and opinions and the results that you're getting. Always remember to credit your sources and the people that assist you. When you're dealing with witnesses, and again, you know, in a very conventional legal sense, if you have 10 people standing on 4 street corners at an intersection and there is a fender bender and they turn at that moment when they hear the sound or some of them see it, you're going to get 10 variations on the same thing. And yet, witness testimony under the right circumstances can condemn someone to death or give them life imprisonment. Always respect the witnesses that you work with. People sometimes say, well, you know, the chances of people faking it, you've always got to be extra careful. Well, I have to say, my own experience of 35 years of interviewing people or sitting as a fly on the wall watching Bud Hopkins do it for about half of our 35-year friendship, during which I worked as his assistant, I've taken part in hundreds of interviews, and overwhelmingly, I come away feeling these people are either credible or absolutely convinced that what they experienced was real for them. And just, again, a note to always respect the witnesses that we work with. When you feel that somebody is getting in your face or accusing you of something that you're not guilty of or challenging your research in an antisocial way, always fight hard, but fight fair. Never let yourself get caught up in generalizations, even though it is a pain in a word maybe I can't say on the radio.
you can say whatever you want, Peter.
I can say ass? Okay,
yes,
if not,
say ass.
Then you're off the air. All right, beautiful. Ass and hell, great. This is all going good for me. I'm so easily entertained. Always hold yourself to your highest standard. Fight hard, but fight fair and cite evidence. Never generalize. Also, never confuse your own personal beliefs, no matter how heartfelt or long-term, with actual empirical evidence, because they're neither. If you learn after the fact that you've made an error, and I discussed this earlier, always correct yourself. Do it in public if possible. Make sure people know. I tell you, in this overwhelmingly still macho culture, that George Bush, Dick Cheney ethic of toughing it out, of no circumspection, of I do it all the same way again, I stand by everything that I've done, is beyond idiotic. It's destructive, arrogant, and illusionary. Admit your errors, correct them, people will respect you for it. And always tell the truth, no matter how awkward or weird it is, to the best of what your findings are around it. And as they say, when you tell the truth, you never have to remember anything. And I hope that doesn't sound too preachy, but again, they apply to every area of what all of us are doing pretty much. Again, for me, it's a matter of holding yourself to your highest, best standard. And when you fall off that self-made pedestal, don't hide the fact.
Well, some people don't even realize they've been knocked off that pedestal, and they just keep going on as they have. And it's but the thing is, I think some of those people, less people will listen to them at that point. Nick has been quiet for a while. I'm sorry, Nick.
Oh, no, that's fine. I was just listening to what the guys are saying. But, I mean, to sort of go back to your point that sort of led to this question, this specific set of questions, Greg, where you talked about, you know, trusting the witness and so on, I think there's actually another angle to this, and that's to what extent can we trust not the witnesses, but trust the phenomenon? And, I mean, for example...
Yeah.
This sort of gets back to things like Valet's messengers of deception, the idea that, you know, there's a phenomenon, but is it what it appears to be? I mean, you can look back into a lot of the particularly 50s reports and 60s where you have sightings and reports of aliens collecting soil samples. You know, that was like a classic aspect of that era.
Yeah.
And so you had this imagery develop of, you know, alien scientists coming down and doing the sorts of things that we would do, you know, taking soil samples and plants and that kind of thing and analyzing them. Well, my view would be, what I find interesting isn't so much the reports of aliens being seen taking soil samples, it's why there were so many reports where people just happened to be in the right place at the right time to see them taking soil samples.
Great.
In other words, it comes across like a staged event to create a mindset within the mind of the witness. And I think, you know, I mean, it's like the contactee movement. I got criticized because my book on the contactees, which came out in 2009, which has the stunningly original name of Contactee. That book, a lot of people criticized it because they thought I was just going to knock the whole thing, whereas I actually think the contactee movement, a lot of, yes, you know, it's like any aspect of the phenomenon. You have fantasies and you have hoaxes. But I think a lot of these people had genuinely weird interactions in the same way people have gone out to desert locations for thousands of years and had interactions with higher entities. You know, you can pick up a Bible and find that out, you know. And I think it's, there's not much difference between these reports of people going out into the, you know, the California desert and communing with some long-haired, almost angelic-looking alien from some planet with a bizarre name. Not much has changed. So I actually think what we could be seeing is one phenomenon that subtly and sometimes drastically changes its appearance or its modus operandi for the people of that era to, into a form they can relate to. And maybe it's just to, as a form of communication or as a teaching method that we don't necessarily understand how and why it works or how it's supposed to impact on us. So in other words, I think it's not always necessarily, you know, a case of, well, we need to try and figure out what the witness actually saw or didn't. You know, what they saw or their memories may not be dictated so much by themselves, but by how the phenomenon appears. You know, I simply don't think it's coincidence or accident that so many people saw, like I said, aliens taking soil samples or, you know, they coming out the flight source, they're running back to it because they just happened to be seen at the last moment.
Or hairy dwarves in South like America only.
There's an agenda going on to try and create almost like a meme of one particular thing, you know.
Or what do you think of the idea that it's the same in every era, yet our ideas of what it should be or could be are changing, and we're putting our imprimatur of what we think it should be on that experience in a wide scale, you know, through a...
Well, I mean, it could be something like that. I mean, you only have to go back to... I mean, God knows, you know, England, where I'm originally from, has a long history of fairy lore, goblins, you know, brownies, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if you look at a lot of those reports from the 15 and 1600s, you know, you'd have somebody going through the woods home late at night and they see what was known as like a fairy light. Well, could that be a UFO? Fairies are these diminutive beings that would take, you know, snatch a man and take him to the fairy kingdom because the fairy kingdom, you know, they had problems reproducing and they would, the fairy queen would have sex with the man. So you've got like the sexual angle that we have in a lot of abduction stories. And in the same way with abductions, you know, we have stories of the hybrids. Well, in fairy lore, fairies would steal human babies and replace them with like a changeling, as it was known, hoping that the parents wouldn't realize. People used to go to the fairy kingdom, they'd come back, think 2 hours had gone by and 2 days had gone by, so you've got missing time. Now, so in other words, to me, you know, when people start talking about fairies, they talk about the more modern-day world of, you know, Tinkerbell and little glinting lights and Christmas trees. You know, if you look back at those original stories 500 years ago, fairies were like sort of wizened, goblin-like entities that could be malicious or friendly or downright trickster-like or homicidal even. They're very different, you know, to what people think of fairies today. But in other words, you know, our aliens, the fairies of the 16th century, incubus and succubus 1,000 years ago, or 2,000-year-old reports of demonic entities invading bedrooms at night, you know, and raping men and women, that kind of thing. It's all, you can find extreme parallels throughout all of those stories that parallel everything in ufology. So, you know, I whether it's we are putting a different interpretation on how it appears or the phenomenon does it, or perhaps the phenomenon digs into our subconscious, picks out certain iconic imagery and then literally manifests itself in that way so we can relate to it, you know. And but maybe that's why the phenomenon changes so much from Phantom airships to Foo Fighters to flying saucers to flying triangles, and from a long-haired Space Brothers to, you know, the dwarfs in the 50s and the 60s and then the Greys and then the reptilians. Maybe it's the phenomenon is reflecting how we change, and it changes its appearance accordingly.
Yeah. This is what I was suggesting. Yeah. Thank you, Nick. Yeah.
Well, that's a fascinating thought, and I don't think anyone here is going to say no, because there's a lot to it. So one question that is arising is, to what extent does it manifest physical phenomenon? Is it entirely in the mind, or is it somewhat in the mind, or is there a physicality there, and to what extent is there one? And again, I mean, it's one of those things where I am convinced, like I think you seem to be, that there's a mind-to-mind critical component here that's going on with this phenomenon. There is the mental aspect of this is of prime importance. And it's not something, by the way, that I was thinking 20 years ago when I traipsed my way into this field. I wasn't thinking that at all, but I do think it now. So the real question is, to what extent is it the dominant factor, and is it 100% something in our mind and something 100% that is reflected in our consciousness, our social consciousness, and so forth? Or is there an objective, to lack of a better word, physical component that is independent of our thought processes? And I don't know if any of us has an answer.
Yeah, I think most of us would agree that there is some other consciousness that is impinging upon ours and may involve in some way physicality.
Right.
And in some cases, a lot more obvious than others. But yeah,
exactly.
I think a lot of people focus too much on things coming from other planets and structured craft, where that I believe that that's kind of an illusion, or at least enough of an illusion that we ought to consider other avenues for the source of some of these reports.
Well, it doesn't. I agree with you, Greg. It doesn't provide. It doesn't seem to provide a complete explanation, at least in many of the cases.
Yeah,
there's
nothing.
A lot of strangeness with this.
Yeah, and, like you said, nothing does.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still. I mean, I have no problem saying this. I'm not comfortable tossing out the ETH entirely. I think that there's probably that's a theory that's got some legs left to it,
yeah.
But. Is it complete? No, I think that there's probably much more. Isn't a valet who said, I would really be disappointed if the ETH was the one that turned out to be the case. It's just so pedestrian compared with everything else.
Yeah.
That's a paraphrase. But
I don't think Nick or I or a lot of people are throwing it out. It's just, as Nick said, it's to de-emphasize it in favor of some other things. Put the spotlight on other things for a while.
I completely agree. Lee, I've come to agree completely with that.
Yeah.
One thing I would just boil down on that very quickly, just take a minute, would be that I think that when Richard said, is it internal or external, I think the phenomenon, whether it's extraterrestrial, interdimensional, whatever it is,
yes.
I think the phenomenon is extraterrestrial, but I think it kind of rips imagery out of our subconscious and maybe has the ability to, it's hypothetical, but maybe it can manifest, as I said, according to the popular imagery of the era. It pulls an imagery out of the human mind and then presents itself in that form, perhaps in something along the lines of a dreamlike state, but it's very real, or like a holographic state. It tries and presents itself to the witness in a way that is acceptable to the witness of that era.
That's a fascinating idea, Nick.
Yeah, when people say that we should throw out the ETH, there is one paper that I really enjoyed. It was the one for the British Interplanetary Society that was written by, Bruce Maccabee and a few other people. It was called Inflation Theory Implications for Extraterrestrial Visitation or something like that. And it talked about the latest theories in physics that would possibly be in play if some sort of entities from other planets had figured out a way to not actually have to traverse physical space. And theoretically, it was possible, according to them. And that, to me, is probably one of the best arguments for an ETH, at least some sightings and encounters and things like that. That would be a great argument for that. I had one other issue, and I think we sort of brought it up. And we can I don't know about you guys, but I don't have a show after me, and I can go a little late if it's all right. I heard it's people. It's like almost one in the morning there. So we can cut it off, and we're going to cut it off. But and I appreciate you guys staying up so late. But
I loved it.
Yeah,
glad to do it again sometime.
The other thing which we started trying to narrow things down, but there was one thing we kind of stopped before we talked about it, and that was, I think we did stop it, was the issue of popularity, ego. Am I going to be in the club if I say this unpopular thing?
Yep.
And how can we guard against that? Because I think it stops different ideas. It stops alternative research and open discussion, I think, in a lot of cases. Would you agree? Any of you?
I guess what I would say is, I think everyone has to be on guard about it. For my part, I don't really know how to speak about myself here. I intentionally alienated myself years ago from MUFON, knowing that I was going to say things at their symposium that would eternally piss them off. And in fact, didn't eternally, but it kicked me out of their club for a long time, and I didn't care. I think a good researcher has to take the attitude of you're riding a line. On the one hand, you want to respect colleagues,
yes,
and not have this idea that you think you figured everything out and you're so smart and everyone else is so stupid. That's just arrogance, and it's usually not true. On the other hand, you have to be brave, and you have to stand by your principles. And if you think it's not popular, then you should do it anyway. If it's what you believe is correct. I think the ultimate solution is in one's productivity. So if you have ideas that are different, put them down, formulate them, write them out in a form that others will be able to engage, whether this is in video or whether it's in books or in articles or whatever. And you just battle it out. It's in the realm of ideas. And, who really gives a shit if you get invited to conferences or not? I mean, honestly, I do a lot of them, but honestly, I'm not doing any this summer, and I'm very happy about it. I get tired of them. And if I did not get invited to another speaking engagement from this point onward, honestly, it wouldn't break my heart. I have other things that I would want to be doing. I've never asked ever to speak anywhere. I'm lucky in that I get invited, and it's fun, and I enjoy the travel, but...
Right.
Honestly, if that's what we're talking about, that's a really poor indication. If someone has their ego fixated on, oh, I didn't get invited to this or that, that's not what it's about. There's some great research and great work being done by people who don't go to the conferences, as anyone who's in this field knows.
Right, exactly.
If I can just jump in.
And we do this for ourselves. We don't.
Yeah, just to say.
Yeah, I didn't know if someone was jumping in.
That's fine. It's Peter.
Even though... We are all, we've spent 2 hours here talking about highly focused research, work, philosophies, theories, ideas behind it. The four of us, and I know this about the four of us, there is something that we're all doing that is extraordinarily important, which I think feeds our curiosity, our desire to contribute, to be in dialogue like this, which is live an interesting life. Take chances. Be creative. Take creative risks. See as much of the world as you can. Make friends that are different than you. Enjoy the drama of living your life. And for anybody that thinks that the specialty areas that we research mean sitting, you know, in your home office or an archive or doing interviews with people all day, that would be kind of a sad, really self-contained way to live your lives. It is an adventure. The work that we've chosen, the paths that we've chosen, are fairly radical and certainly not the best choice we could have made for financial security or status in this world.
Yeah.
But I know, you know, you three guys are good friends of mine, and even though we don't see each other sometimes for a long time, the respect, the care, the fun that we have when we're together is emblematic for me about what's best on the paths that we've chosen. So no matter what you do, what book you're writing, what research you're doing, lighten the hell up, have a good time, have adventures, you know, wear black all the time like Nick. No, just kidding. Not all the time. I've seen you in colors occasionally. And... you know, you have smiled. It's true.
I do occasionally, yeah.
The whole idea of researchers The idea of researchers and ego, I don't really know where this originated from, but I'm trying to think of researchers who base their research
I'm not saying
will be popular.
Yeah, I don't think people do that all the time or consciously. I think it is a factor with some people, even if you don't acknowledge it. I mean, I know for the time where I was speaking at a lot of conferences, I was thinking, are people going to like this? I wouldn't change what I was going to say just because I thought people would like it or not. But definitely, I wanted people to like it.
No, you must never change it.
Yeah. So, you know,
but the thing is,
I can see it, you know, that you have to guard against it.
I'm very lucky. I have a great dad, and my dad's a retired New York City cop. And in fact, I grew up in a family of cops. And my father, actually, this is really true, he was kind of like a chubbier version of Frank Serpico, if you remember Serpico.
You told me that before, yeah.
And, he also fought a losing battle against a lot of police corruption in New York City. And my dad's career is actually a great career and a tragic career. But I will never forget, I was about 10 years old.
What a great role model.
I was a skinny little kid. And my dad, yeah, we're all flawed, every one of us. But my dad is a great guy. But he was in the middle of his battles, you know, with his police department and locking up the perps and all of this stuff. And I was sitting on the couch next to him, and he put his enormous hand on my skinny little knee, and he said, "Now I'm going to tell you something. You're going to go through life fighting your own battles." And here I am, I'm 10 years old, thinking, "Battles? What is he talking about?" I had no idea. And he said, "And you might be surrounded by 1,000 hostile people, and you might be a minority of one. And nevertheless, if you have justice, and if you have integrity, and if you have truth on your side, you are not going to give up. You are going to fight, and you're going to prevail. You understand me?" And I was this little 10-year-old kid, and I just nodded my head, like, "Yes, okay." But he poured this this idea. I mean, honestly, it is so integral to how I perceive myself. I on a personal level, I could never just do a thing because I think, "Oh, this is, people will like me." That's the most bullshitty attitude that I can conceive of. And I have no respect for anyone that I perceive does that. Mm-hmm. You do something because you're obsessed by it. You do something because you have a demon inside you that tells you, "I've got it. You have to research this thing." And I know Peter's that way, and I know you're that way, Greg, and I know Nick is that way. We research things because we want to. I don't want to. I have to.
Yeah.
And there's no way I'm going to go off and work for goddamn Xerox or do some corporate gig. I want to research the questions that fascinate me. And if no one else cares, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
For me, I like to have a communication with other people. And you know, if they agree with me, great. If they don't agree with me, then I'd like to know why. But I think any good researcher is going to pursue something because they're genuinely obsessed. And if you're not genuinely obsessed, then in my view, you really have no business doing what you do. You should throw yourself into it with all of your passion and make yourself vulnerable in the process, because the fact is, you cannot succeed unless you throw yourself on the altar of this topic. And you have to be willing I'm going to drop it. You have to be willing to fuck up.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah,
and if you're not willing to do that, then don't go in. It's going to mess you up at times.
I mean,
life and reality and these questions are difficult. And but for me, there's nothing, not one thing in this world that's more worthwhile for me to pursue than these types of issues and these questions, because I'm naturally curious and I want to know. And even if I'll never really know, that's fine too. I want to do my best. And so ego. It's always a fine line when you get a lot of ego strokes. I get a lot in my on my Facebook wall, and there are people who just, you know, they love me, and it's like, "Oh my God, what is this?" And then there are people who hate me. I mean, I get both of them. But my attitude and you know, we're all we succeed and fail to this at various degrees. You cannot allow yourself to get too attached to that. That's a downward spiral. It is about the research. It's about the work. It's about the ideas. It's not about you. It's never about you. And when I talk about research, I almost, it's very rare that I will mention other researchers as if I have a problem with them, because I don't really want to have wars with people. I don't want to get into personality issues. I want to stick to the ideas rather than get into some kind of stupid personality conflict with another person who may not like me, you know?
Right.
So there we go. That's my, you asked, and that's my answer on it.
Very well said. Nick, we've almost run out of time. Do you have a final thing you would like to say?
Well, really, I think when we do shows like this, I think the important thing is what the listeners, you know, get from it. And I would hope, you know, they realize that, you know, we make good points, and that, you know, people realize why we're in the subject, what it means, and importantly, that we are, you know, we do have concerns about the future of ufology and where it's leading and where it should lead. And I think that's encouraging, that, you know, we've spent 2 hours discussing the important aspect of ufology because we recognize the importance of it, you know. We're not just, you know, spilling, oh, have you heard the latest about this case or that one? No, we've actually tried to offer some meaningful way for, you know, for ufology as a field to progress. And of course, you know, it doesn't matter how many more reports, UFO reports surface, if there isn't a community or people are willing to look into the cases, well, they're just going to fall into obscurity. So I think, you know, to do what we've done is, you know, to debate something like this is an important issue. And, you know, I hope the listeners will sort of recognize that as well.
The main reason...
You know, the future of you...
Go ahead.
I'm so sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, there's a couple of key things, like we really didn't discuss that we should in another show. Right?
Okay, we'll continue this.
I mean, the fact that, you know, the UFO data is really restricted primarily to North America in any comprehensive way. The fact that very few of these things are ever really investigated. The fact that we have social media, which is copy and paste rumor. The decline of professional journalism. A shortage of true investigation into anomalous phenomena. You had all of the people going out there making their predictions, whether it was back Project Bluebeam or Comet Elenine or, you know, the ascension of 2012 that was supposed to happen. Or even more practical things like just getting an appreciation of drone technology and classified drones, which are, all these things are off the charts advanced. I mean, there is a lot of issues. The fact that we need international collaboration, which we're really not getting, but we could get in an age of Google Translate. I think there's a lot of opportunities for really good, valuable UFO research to move ahead into some productive ways.
Right. The way it can do it, I think one of those ways is small, unheralded, smart people working in small groups and reporting their findings. I think the creativity could come out of that rather than as you'd want to, rather than a large group. The main reason that I wanted to do this was hash out all these things. But the other thing I was thinking as you guys were summing up here was, these things are posted. I have a live show because I like it, but they're posted, and I want people to hear this, and I want people to be able to hear it over and over again. And maybe, you know, a few people listening to it will say, hey, wait a second, and we'll hear from those people in 5 or 10 years, and they'll change everything. That's kind of what I hope every time I do a show. So any guest I have on I just feel is like a gift, and thank you so much, all of you, for coming on and being on the show and being patient with me at certain times. So thanks, Peter, Nick,
nice.
And
glad
Rich.
To.
Thanks for having me on.
All right.
Great speaking to all you guys.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, and as Rich said, I think we only touched on a few things, and we should do this again, either separately or together, or whatever. And if you guys are willing to do that, I will get in touch with you soon.
Can do.
All right.
For sure.
See you later, guys.
All right. Like I said, Rich, you're the new guy. What piece of music would you like to hear at the end of the show?
Oh, wow. I hadn't really thought about this.
Or you can tell me later, and I will edit it in. We are still live.
Honestly, man, there's a lot of great music out there.
Rammstein.
Yeah, Rammstein.
Really generous of you.
Because that's become a tradition. Whoever the guest is, I let them pick. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. You know what I was just listening to the other day?
What?
I had something totally retro on. I was listening to Curtis Mayfield sing Superfly. Put Superfly on. It'll make me happy.
There it is.
That's well, all right. Do it. Thank you. That made me happy.
There you go. Well, thanks so much, you guys, and I'll talk to you soon.
I'm you bet.
All right.
Hey,
thanks,
guys.
Greg. Very much.
Bye, Tim.
Bye.
Yeah.
Darkest of night with the moon shining bright. There's a set going strong, a lot of things going on. The man of the hour has an air of great power. The dudes have envied him for so long. Oh, super fly. You're gonna make your fortune by and by. But if you lose, don't ask no questions why. The only game you know is do or die. Hard to understand, but a hell of a man. This cat of the slum had a mind, wasn't dumb. But a weakness was shown, cause his hustle was wrong. His mind was his own, but the man lived alone. You're gonna make your fortune by and by. But if you lose, don't ask no questions why. The only game you know is do or die. The game he plays for keeps. Hustling times in ghetto streets, trying to get over. That's what he's trying to do, y'all. The aim of his role was to move a lot of blow. Ask him his dream, what does it mean? He wouldn't know. Can't be like the rest, it's the most he'll confess. But the time's running out and there's no happiness. Ooh, Superfly. You're gonna make your fortune by and by. But if you lose, don't ask no questions why. The only game you know is do or die. Superfly.